Yeah, so as I'm going, I don't know, please just feel free to interrupt if you have any questions or anything. Just shout it out and I'll try and answer it. So as the title says, I'm going to be talking a little bit about a project I've been working on, kind of using the tools of numerical relativity applied to, in particular, late universe cosmology. And I recognize a couple people from Galaxies of Cosmology. This is basically the long version of that 12-minute talk. So, this was done in collaboration with Tom Giblin from Kenyon College and my advisor, Glenn Starkman from Case Western. This has been in the can for a couple years. We put out a couple of papers on this about a year ago, kind of detailing the evolution of our numerical spacetime and results, what the behavior that we saw. And then more recently, actually did optical calculations in the spacetime, so trying to compute observable quantities, tracking photons, looking at how they redshift, and that sort of thing through our spacetime. So, so using the full framework of general relativity, what types of questions do we hope to be able to answer or address using this type of work? These kind of fall into a couple umbrella categories, I guess. The first of these being, what sort of effects are there due to small scale structure? How does this influence the overall evolution of the universe? So questions surrounding so-called Beck reaction. And there haven't really been definitive conclusions about this, but using this sort of technique, we hope to be able to provide more insight. And of course, in general, we're going to want to phrase things rather in terms of, say, metric quantities, which is more of a mathematical question, in terms of observational quantities. So looking at optical properties of our spacetime, looking at photons as they traverse. Okay, complementing this, we can also ask the question, how large are corrections to the usual assumptions we make in cosmology? Typically we assume an FLRW background, FLRW model, and on top of that, Newtonian perturbations, or in general, use a perturbation theory, a perturbative framework, in order to describe the spacetime. In the full framework of general relativity, there are, of course, corrections to that, and we're interested in exploring how large are these corrections, is there an impact on observables, and we're hoping that tools from numerical relativity will allow us to model this with sufficient accuracy to answer questions like that. I want to provide a little bit more context. So I've thrown up a bunch of author names here and some dates. Work applying numerical relativity to cosmology, dates back to the 1980s when people became more serious about using numerical relativity and techniques. These range from questions like, use the hockey stick. These first couple of papers are kind of looking at phase transitions, QCD transitions, also nucleosynthesis, I want that in there, that type of thing. There have been papers looking at these kind of things, the evolution of gravitational waves produced during phase transitions, seeing how the amplitude of gravitational wave spectra are affected in the full context of GR as opposed to using linearized approximations. The list kind of goes on. More recently, there have been studies looking at inflation and initial conditions. So given a universe with large amplitude fluctuations in the metric, some field that can ostensibly drive inflation, does the universe inflate or not? And that brings us to late universe cosmology, which is kind of what I'm gonna be talking about or interested in. The earliest work I could find that really tried to go after this in a realistic context was this paper in 1998, which was a 1+1 dust evolution paper, or more general hydrodynamics paper in 1+1. People have also looked at, this was a set of black hole lattice simulations. So what happens if all the matter in your universe is lumped into, say, 8 black holes or something, or a handful of black holes? what do the properties of that space-time look like? There's also been work on modeling cold dark matter using scalar fields in full numerical relativity. These were a set of, symmetry restricted simulations done using scalar fields as a cold dark matter model. I guess most recently in late universe cosmology, we've looked at modeling cold dark matter using a pressureless fluid. And this was the work that I've done along with Tom and Glenn, and then also Eloisa Benavigna and Marco Bruni put out a similar paper. So that kind of brings us up to the present day. We're now looking at, in these space times, the optical properties of them. Okay, so before we get to what we actually see in these universes, what our observers see, I want to go through basically the tools we need in order to ask these type of questions. So we use a 3+1 formulation of numerical relativity called the BSSN formulation or formalism. Make some slight adjustments to it to tune it to cosmological context. And then just some details of the code, different tests we've run, and then finally applying it to late universe cosmology, what do our initial conditions look like in our universe, and what kind of dust do we put in there, and then what do our observers actually see, what kind of observables can we compute. I don't know what fraction of the audience are numerical relativists versus cosmologists, but I'm going to go through some of the, numerical relativity 101. So what we do is, the standard 3+1 decomposition, write your space-time metric as a spatial metric, a metric on, spatial foliations in the space-time. These spatial foliations with some time-like separation described by the lapse parameter alpha, and then perhaps with a coordinate shift also described by parameter beta. In the BSSN formulation, we're going to also perform a conformal decomposition, so decompose the three metric into a conformal metric with unit determinant. So we have an algebraic constraint that it's going to need to satisfy, and then a conformal piece sitting out front of it. We can take this, write Einstein's equations in terms of these variables. We get the so-called BSSN equations. I've written these down in synchronous gauge, so that's unit lapse and zero shift. So Einstein's equations are, of course, a set of second-order partial differential equations. So not only do we have evolution equations for the metric and the conformal factor, but also the time derivatives of those. And we've also, in the BSSN formulation, there's this additional variable, which is a contraction of a Christoffel symbol, a conformal Christoffel symbol. That's basically added so you don't have to take mixed derivatives, which aids with numerical stability. And then these are also written in a form to basically help numerical stability. So you don't have to worry about your code breaking down as quickly as you would and say just a straight up ADM decomposition. So this is gravity. There are, of course, source terms. So we have matter density, basically a pressure piece, a Tij piece, and a trace free part of a Tij piece. We have all these source terms for the equations, or for the gravity sector. In particular, as I mentioned, we're gonna be interested in cold dark matter. So in the case of synchronous gauge, this turns out to obey simply a conservation law. So all you have to do is pick an initial density, and then in synchronous gauge, you don't even have to evolve that field. It's just gonna act as a continuous source for the Einstein equations.
Yes. Go ahead. So I mean, this will break down this particular gauge, mm-hmm. the caustics or things like that.
Yes.
Do you find situations arise like that, your simulations, you have to stop them?
If we evolve for long enough and have small enough scale fluctuations, yes, we do see, we would see shocks and caustics. The bigger problem is that in synchronous gauge, so we have this conservation law, which means that really the coordinates are tracking the motion of the fluid through the space-time, and so you run into coordinate singularities when basically when you would have fluid elements cross. So if you have two galaxies collide or something, then we run into
basically. That's the same problem with that too. Caustics is exactly that.
Okay. But they're also just fluid shocks rather than a coordinate problem.
You don't have fluids. You just have dust.
Yeah. But this won't resolve, say, multi-streaming or crossing of fluid elements.
So I mean, that's the main problem, right? Because the standard CDM structures for hierarchy, so you first form the small structures early on. And so in case as soon as that happens, then the code breaks down.
Yes. And so what we can do so far is basically very large scale evolutions, looking at things on, of order hundreds of megaparsecs or larger. So.
I have to worry about averaging meta versus geometry.
So in this formulation, we haven't worried about averaging anything yet. These are just Einstein equations for a perfect fluid.
Don't worry about the average.
There are no assumptions of averaging yet.
There are not assumptions yet. You're assuming a perfect fluid.
We are assuming a perfect fluid, yes.
So what about these back reactions? So
to really answer those questions, I guess we'll need to be able to resolve small enough scales that we're resolving, say, galaxies, stars, and we're not quite at that point yet. So I don't want to make definitive statements about that. But we're hoping that eventually this type of technique will be able to provide more definite answers to questions like that.
Okay. Can I ask you a question? So I mean, why didn't you use a gauge if it doesn't break down as before?
Just because it's so simple to evolve the matter source. So if you don't,
it kind of defeats the purpose because I mean the reason you're doing a simulation is to get a more precise, more accurate picture.
True. Yes. But we're not resolving scale small enough where this is an issue anyways. Not yet. So we are working on an n-body type code as well, and that's in the pipeline as well. And so eventually we're hoping to not just use something so simple. But for what I'm going to talk about, this is what we've done so far. So. So also, of course, we have basically the 0, 0, and 0i components of the Einstein equations, the Hamiltonian momentum constraint equations, which must be obeyed on all the spatial slices. And so we can also use these equations to determine initial conditions for our space-time. But suffice to say that we just monitor the amount of violation we see in these constraints. We can use these equations for that purpose, at least. Okay, so so in order to tailor this formulation to cosmology in particular, we use what's called a reference metric formulation of the BSSN equations. Which all that really means is we take the BSSN equations and we subtract off the FRW solution, and then we have these difference variables, and then we, instead of evolving the metric itself, evolve these difference variables, and it's still fully relativistic. There are some assumptions going into this. This is just kind of a trick to reduce numerical error. Go ahead.
Are you assuming that the difference is small?
So we're not presuming that the difference is small, but in regimes where the difference is small, we hope that this will, reduce the amount of error. So this should let us resolve smaller fluctuations around in FRW spacetime without loss of numerical precision.
So I've seen similar things before in puncture evolutions, for example. Mm-hmm. That one usually uses a multiplicative ansatz for the metric. That is the conformal factor, phi, I don't know what formulation that here is. You don't subtract something, you divide by something, or so.
Yeah, so.
And similar
so,
for the metric.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
you're
I think.
Subtracting a delta.
Cool. Yeah, we are subtracting a delta from the metric, yeah.
So the resulting equations are not BSSN anymore, right? They're very different.
These are almost the BSSN equations. The main difference is you just have this delta K KFRW term in the equations. And you could write down, you know, a more general set of equations if you really wanted. You know, if you have any reference metric, you can subtract that from the BSSN equations and just solve the differences. And it's still a fully relativistic calculation. The only goal here is just to reduce numerical error.
So you're not dropping any terms?
Yeah, we're not dropping any terms.
Infinite locking point accuracy, there would be no difference.
Say that again?
With infinite accuracy, there would be no difference.
Yeah, correct, okay. Yeah. So as I said, these end up being precisely the same equations as the BSSN equations. The only difference is now we have this FRW piece. And again, this makes no assumptions on as to what the actual space-time looks like. It's just a trick for when you're near the FRW solution to try and gain a little bit of accuracy there. Okay. So the BSSN equations themselves, the Hamiltonian and momentum constraint violation, if you write down the equations of motion for the constraint violation themselves, what you end up with is that they obey basically a source damped wave equation or type equation that looks like that. If you're in, say, a regime where you have a black hole and you're in an asymptotically flat spacetime, this is fine because your constraint violation can propagate out of the system or fall into your black hole and stay there. But in cosmology, if we're in a periodic spacetime with no singularities, then it's more of an issue because these constraints, they just persist. So we explored a couple of different ideas for reducing the amount of constraint violation we see and trying to prevent it from just sitting around and accumulating, which is something we do see happen. So we tried this Z4C formulation, which I'm not really going to talk about. So we can turn on these terms. It ends up not being too helpful. We also tried these suggestions from this author Duez. These additions right here are basically, they look more or less like diffusive terms. So the idea is to not necessarily damp the amount of constraint violation, but to, if you have one region that's generating a lot of constraint violation, hopefully it'll kind of smooth it away or average it away. And then this last term here kind of can be seen, at least if you look at the equations expanded around Minkowski space, it does look like the addition of a damping term to the wave equation. So we tried adding these in as well. And so here's a plot demonstrating the performance of these. We have a universe. We just put in a single long wavelength dipole mode in this universe. We have just a straight up BSSN formulation, the amount of error. We do see that, indeed, this does kind of grow without bound. The constraint is just continually sourced and doesn't end up going away. This reference metric formulation, at least in regimes where the amplitude of fluctuations are small and error is dominated by numerical precision, then we do see we get this nice reduction in constraint violation magnitude. And then these diffusive type terms, those have a similar effect, but especially at late times, they help, avoid the accumulation of constraint violation in a particular area.
So this is an exponential growth of the constraints, right? Because it's a log linear scale?
Log linear, yeah. So
parallel. It's pi bar.
This is a proxy for time. It's the average conformal factor. It's more or less the FRWA, the FRW scale factor. E to the phi is like
e to the phi is like
a.
Yeah.
Or e to the,
is this time or log time on the right?
This is the average conformal factor in the simulation, which is a proxy for time in a cosmological setting. This isn't time. This is just the more or less the number of e-folds your universe has expanded.
If you were using iterations. If you were using iterations, iteration numbers. Would they look the same, or is it a lot of the iteration number? What is it?
I don't have a good answer for that because I can make a plot if you want and show you later.
This is log time. So this is a log plot.
It's a log time.
So this is a polynomial growth of the constraints then, not an exponential.
Log log. Yeah.
Okay. But a polynomial growth is acceptable. It's not as bad as an exponential growth. But this curve still looks much worse than what I would have expected. I would have expected that if you use the you don't have the zeta 4c in there, right?
No, but that still doesn't actually help that much. And I think some of that is the gauge we're using. So z4c is constraint damping, I think, in particular when you're in harmonic gauge.
I think the harmonic gauge is ill-posed, yes, and we need to do something else.
But we are
it's well known that the Hamiltonian constraint in a pure BSSM formulation is not damped, so that it should continue to grow. And that would be bad. And the zeta 4c formulation should fix that. And of course, there are probably similar ones as well. And they're also
In
a formulation similar to BSSM would fix that.
Yeah, and specifically, I think it fixes it in harmonic gauge, not synchronous gauge, which we are using here. But eventually, if we were to do, say, this general n-body thing, we wouldn't have this restriction of synchronous gauge, and so there's a strong desire to basically not use the fluid formulation that we're currently using.
Okay. So I'm interested in the details. I'm going to catch you later.
Okay.
So is the y-axis that's the constraint violation normalized by the average constraint?
Normalized by so this h bar that I've written down here is the sum of the squares of all the terms in the Hamiltonian constraint. So roughly, this is percent constraint violation. It's more or less normalized.
How the max compares to the average, basically, or
the maximum percent constraint violation in the simulation. I guess, but in a wishy-washy sort of way. So this I don't know. I can tell you more details later, I guess.
Yeah. So I guess my question is that h bar, is that determined each time step? That's like some average.
It's not averaged in any sense. It's just the local sum of squares of the terms in the Hamiltonian constraint.
Okay.
So what it ends up being is basically the density, because that's the density or the k squared term. Those are what dominate the dynamics. So it's the constraint violation relative to the energy scale in the problem. That's another way of saying it. So we have this code. We're interested in testing it, of course. So we would like to test it in different regimes. I'm just going to show a few of the tests we've done here. So if we're near an FRW solution, we should be able to just run this without fluctuations and see plain FRW. And we do to high degree of precision, which is great.
Is it numerical roundoff because of the
linear formula? Not quite to numerical roundoff, I guess. There's still accumulated like order dt to whatever power integrator you're using.
Okay, the way you reformulate the equations, like you
won't. Oh, okay. Yes. So I guess I should say we evolved the. The FRW solution is not. We don't actually plug in an analytic solution. We integrate that numerically as well, as we go. So there is still the roundoff error, the integrator error. Okay, so we can also test this in a regime where we have, say, wave-like behavior. Einstein's equations linearized. We can have gravitational wave solutions, and we can plug this solution in, evolve this for many box crossing times, and make sure that we do indeed see this wave-like behavior. So we have an analytic and a numeric solution plotted on top of each other here, and we do see that they agree. We can also test this in strongly gravitating regimes. So what happens if we take one of these black hole trumpet solutions, plug that in? Again, we can see that if we have an analytic and a numeric solution, that more or less they do agree. So, Okay, so you know we trust this code.
So what is the black hole solution?
So this is just a Schwarzschild solution in a particular coordinate system, suitable for a vacuum solution. Yeah, and there's no matter in here. So
there's no problem doing the black hole in the synchronous gauge.
And this is also not in the synchronous gauge, I should say. So in cosmology, we're going to be interested in synchronous gauge, but this is not synchronous gauge. This test is not synchronous gauge.
But I don't understand. So your formulation was for synchronous gauge, so.
The formulation is more general. I just, for the sake of saving space, didn't write out the shift and lapse terms, but there are shift and lapse terms there as well.
So what exactly do you mean by synchronous gauge? Do you exactly set lapse to one and shift to zero,
for example? For the cosmologies, yes, yes. Okay, and we can also look at the performance of our code as we increase resolution and make sure we're converging to continuum solutions. And so we do this basically by running cosmological simulations at increasing resolutions. And so these are errors from cosmological runs. And we see that as we increase the resolution, indeed the amount of error decreases. And decreases approximately as we expect. So this is just a plot of basically the convergence rate, the numerical convergence rate that we expect, given the order finite difference scheme that we use. And we do see that we are converging. So this is a good sign. Okay. All right. So getting to cosmology now. So how do we set initial conditions for our simulation? So as I said before, the Hamiltonian and momentum constraints have to be obeyed on every spatial hypersurface. This includes the initial conditions. We have to make sure this equation is satisfied on our initial surface. So what we can do is kind of break the Hamiltonian constraint into different pieces that resemble, say, the FRW plus Newtonian solutions. So it involves basically taking the density and turning it into a piece that sources some overall expansion and a piece that contains all the fluctuations. And then we end up with this piece that sources the overall expansion. It's just going to be a constant term for our model here. And then this piece ends up sourcing the conformal factor in front of the metric. And this, as I said, contains all the fluctuations. And so this piece right here, we just have an algebraic relation that needs to be satisfied constraint that needs to be satisfied. And this, in FRW language, is just one of the Friedmann equations. If you translate variables, and then this piece sourcing the conformal factor obeys this nonlinear Poisson equation. And so in a Newtonian limit, if you say linearize this, then you just end up with Newtonian gravity. Going back to those kind of two initial umbrella questions, one way of thinking about that is how we have kind of the overall expansion of the universe. Well, how well during the course of our run does this equation remain satisfied? And how well is this satisfied also? So, go ahead.
So you effectively assumed FRW is a geometrical space type. Mm-hmm.
Yes. For our initial conditions, we've chosen initial conditions close to an FRW space time. Yes.
I meant to tell the body solutions, the exact solution. Mm-hmm. What happens if you choose that as the background?
So we have not looked at that. That would be interesting to look at.
You have?
We have not looked at that. Okay. That would be interesting to look at, though.
So you won't get these equations?
You would not.
You
would get different equations, I guess, yeah.
So that's a restriction.
It's, I guess.
It's an assumption. Okay.
Yeah, it's an assumption, or whatever you want to call it. Yeah, it's just a choice that we're choosing initial conditions that look like FRW with some fluctuations. So So you know, it'd be great to model different setting, you know, different initial conditions, but that's not something we've done yet.
So you're looking for perturbations from FRW, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm a bit confused here. So you say you assume it's conformal flat, but also you're using synchronous gauge.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they are consistent, but you can, you don't have enough gauge freedom in DR to use synchronous gauge and also assume that the spatial metric is conformally flat, because, I mean, if you...
It's conformally flat on, well, flat only on the initial slice, only on the initial surface.
Right, but then I think, I mean, if you just use the standard scalar fluctuations in synchronous gauge, there would be... there would be non-conformal flat terms in GIJ. There would be second derivatives of a scalar perturbation, EIJ. So basically what you're assuming right now is that the only perturbation in metric is the conformal factor of the spatial metric.
Mm-hmm.
And everything else is
correct,
set
yeah.
to zero.
And I mean, this is a solution. It's
This is a solution.
On the initial surface, at least. We're not saying that the
question, if it evolves, is it okay? So I guess what I'm saying is that the retransient modes that would decay right away. Right?
Sure, and you should see that. I mean, this does not remain true. This is just a statement on the initial surface only.
Yeah, I think you're right. You're good.
I guess I would have imagined the standard simulation, you just start with a growing mode, don't put in a decaying one.
Yeah, right. so we do have some decaying contribution here, yeah. Okay, so the other choice, So given these choices, the momentum constraint equation then is just trivially satisfied. All the terms in it are just zero. So for the fluctuations themselves, we're interested in picking something that resembles cosmology. You know, we're not interested in solving the problem perfectly, but doing something that at least resembles it. So we can pick any power spectrum we like, really, but we pick this one with power law scalings that are at least motivated by calculations done in Newtonian gauge, not really synchronous gauge, but so we pick to have some k-scaling and k to the minus 3 scaling, which you see in Newtonian gauge. And then we can, given this power spectrum, or given a random realization of a universe with this power spectrum, then we can solve for the conformal factor, and then we have our initial conditions. So. Okay. All right. So we have initial conditions. We have evolution of our spacetime given the BSSN formulation. But of course, we're interested in measurable properties, the optical properties of the spacetime. So what we're going to want to do next is ray trace through the spacetime. So our follow photons and look at the properties of beams of light traveling in our spacetime. So here we just have the geodesic equation. We need to rewrite this in a suitable 3+1 form, write it in terms of coordinate time. We can do precisely this. Just if you work through it, then you come up with equations for, say, the energy of a photon, velocity, or really direction that the photon's traveling in, and position of the photon. So we can integrate these equations through the space-time. What we want to do in addition, because we're interested in cosmological observables, is not just integrate along geodesics, but integrate the equations using the geometric optics formalism. So we want to not just track the geodesics, but say beams of light with some infinitesimal area and see how that area changes as it travels along geodesics. In order to actually do this and we're also interested in having all of our rays converge at an observer. And so if you start, say, at some early time and evolve to a later time, we're going to have basically a shooting problem So what we end up doing is evolving our universe from some initial state to a final state, putting down a bunch of photons at an observer, and then actually integrating the whole system backwards in time. So we actually are, you know, picking an observer in our space-time and then tracking back through the universe as it evolves in reverse and trying to look at what it sees. So these equations come from the Sachs optical scalar equations, which basically describe how, if you have a beam of infinitesimal area, how that beam evolves. And you can convert that into quantities standard in cosmology. So you have, rather than just the area of a beam, if you take the square root of that, and then you're basically tracking the diameter of a beam. And so you can relate this to angular diameter distances. And so you can write down an equation for how angular diameter distances evolve as you integrate through your spacetime in full GR. So there's a few source terms. There's this Ricci optical scalar, which is just sourcing, if you're familiar with leaf lensing, basically convergence of the beam. And then you also have this shear term, so which describes how much your beam is stretched or squashed in different directions. And so these both contribute to, these both play a role in describing how the area of your beam changes as it propagates. And then you have, of course, the evolution equation for the shear itself and how that evolves as your spacetime evolves. And so if you take this and linearize this, this should basically reduce to some of the formalism you see in weak lensing. And of course, we want to test our integrator for our beams, and so we can integrate, or we can retrace through universes with analytic metrics, and so we do this. So we can first of all just integrate through an FRW universe and make sure that we are converging so we're actually starting at some future time and integrating backwards in time, and eventually we end up back here. We're close to the Big Bang there, but we can integrate angular diameter distances back in time. See that they agree with the FRW solution. We can also take advantages of the symmetry in FRW spacetime and shoot our beams in different directions just to make sure we've implemented the integrator properly. So there are also the vacuum Kastner solutions. We can integrate through these spacetimes as well and basically ensure that, so we don't have an exact analytic expression for the beam area in this case, but we can nevertheless make sure that the beam area converges and obeys the symmetries that we expect, and then we can also integrate through a universe that's basically has a metric whose components are sinusoidal in nature, and this is not meant to be a physical solution, just to kind of mimic a solution with fluctuations in the metric and make sure that we're doing the correct thing as we integrate through the spacetime. And so it's harder to see here because when you're integrating through a metric with these fluctuations, as you increase resolution, your solutions overlap, and so your convergence rate basically has these asymptotes of places where solutions from different resolutions intersect. So you're kind of doing a 0/0 thing. But nevertheless, you still see that in general you get convergence as expected. So we have our formulation, we have our initial conditions, we have a way of extracting observable information from this universe. Now, of course, we want to perform the actual evolution and look at some results. We'll just go right to it. So when we actually run the code, what do we actually do? Well, this is for now just a unigrade code. So running on a universe described by running this on a regular lattice using usual finite difference schemes, Runcata integrator, fairly standard tools. We also have periodic boundary conditions, which are perhaps different from what you might see in strong gravity things where you have, say, asymptotically flat spacetimes. And we're going to be running for volumes of order Hubble scales. Okay, so when we do this, what do we actually see? So first, I'm going to talk a little bit about what the actual metric components look like.
So what is your resolution?
So we've not run more than like 512 cubed, but for these simulations, it's for most of the runs, it's between like 128 and 256 cubed.
Okay, so it's about it's a Hubble length.
So I think everything here is half a Hubble length.
Okay, so that's like 1500 megaparsec, and then you said what was the 256%?
Yeah. And then there's the additional caveat. So I glossed over this, but so at some point we actually do have to cut off our power spectrum also. Because we want to, you know, be able to resolve all the modes in our simulation by more than just a couple points. So we end up cutting our simulation at some point. So what you're probably asking is what is the what is the smallest mode we're actually resolving? Yeah. And in these simulations, it's of order a 50th to 100th of a Hubble length.
Okay, so I think you said it's a 100th of a Hubble length?
Really like a 50th of a Hubble length.
Okay, so that's 60 megaparsecs.
Yeah, it should be of order like 100 megaparsecs or so. So in terms of the actual metric that we see, so as we evolve the simulation, we can compare it to linear perturbation theory in synchronous gauge. So we can take the BSSN equations, and they end up becoming just a set of coupled ODEs. So we can, you know, just come up with an analytic solution to those and compare our numerical results to this linear approximation. And then we can also look at how the average properties of our spacetime behave compared to the FRW solution. But we can also just see if the Friedman equation remains obeyed to a high degree of precision in our simulation. So up here there's a plot of another slide. Yeah. Okay, so up here there's a plot of maybe it's a little hard to see, but this dashed line here corresponds to the linear solution. Just that comes from solving the linearized equations. And if we plot the difference of the numerical solution around the linear solution, you see this kind of U shape. And if we compare to the FRW solution, just look at the average expansion rate of the volume and the average density in the volume and see if the Friedman equation remains obeyed, we see that, okay, look, it looks like it's, you know, in our model, it looks like it's obeyed to a fairly high degree of precision. So how do we explain this U shape? So what we can do is not throw away one of these nonlinear terms. So rather than writing this as KFRW plus a fluctuation piece, we can just leave it as this K squared term. And it's still at least a set of ODEs. And we can integrate these. And then what we see is this purple dashed line, which is probably even harder to see. So this purple dashed line then is the solution to these equations over here, which do include some nonlinear components. The color map is exactly that. It's just data from the actual simulation. What is the value of the trace of the extrinsic curvature compared to the average, and then the density also plotted versus the density. And then it's just a 2D histogram of that. And so we see, you know, most of the points do agree with linear theory pretty well, but there are these deviations. And then all of this blue pretty much lies below the dashed line here. And that's basically due to the sign of this other term we've neglected. So this is a positive definite term. And so this is forcing all the blue points to lie on one side of these approximate equations. Okay, so now you know this is great. We can talk about actual metric quantities, but of course it's better if we talk about observables. So can we compute actual Hubble diagrams? Yes. So we can do perform the optical integration through our spacetimes. Plot the result, basically. So on this plot, there are three different lines. There's the FRW prediction, which is one of these lines. I don't remember what. And then there's actually about 20 lines on here that are integrations in different lines of sight, all agreeing quite well with each other. And then there's an average line, which I think is the black dashed line. So if we average over many directions of sight, we still see FRW, something that resembles FRW behavior. Okay, so of course we want to then look at residuals around the solution. So this is a plot, it's a Hubble diagram of basically this distance modulus versus redshift. So on this plot there are many squiggly black lines, and these are basically angular diameter distances computed along particular lines of sight. And you can see that along different lines of sight, the photons are feeling different metrics. So the areas of beams are changing in different ways, and you have many of these. And in the background, there's a histogram of over many more lines than I've just plotted here. And you can see there's this distribution. So at low redshift, you see this kind of large amplitude. You kind of see these this envelope that kind of blows up, and in part this is just the units of the distance modulus because it's like logarithmic units, and so the differences in angular diameter distance are actually pretty small here, but we're taking the log of something small, so you see that become large. And then at larger distances, ostensibly you're doing something like random walking away from the FRW solution, and so you see this this envelope broaden. And then on average, that's this thick red line. We see that, perhaps we're sensitive to some local structure where there might be more overdensities or underdensities than on average. But as we probe more and more of our spacetime, we see the average, basically Hubble law obeyed. Okay, so this plot right here is for what I've called an average observer, which is just an observer sitting in a region of average density. So they're not sitting in a large overdensity or underdensity. What we can do is instead put our observer in a large underdensity or overdensity. And in that case, we do see at low redshift very large deviations. Yep.
Voids have been detected, which are almost a gigaparsec in size. So go after a redshift of one more. So there may be bigger ones we haven't seen yet. So how come you don't pick that up?
So this observer is not in a void of order a gigaparsec, I guess. I mean, if we wanted to, we could try and find a realization of a space-time which did have large voids of order that size, and then we could ray trace through that space-time. But that's not something we've done yet.
If you pick them up, the photons coming through a void like that diverge, geometry's different. Yes. So how would you pick this up with your speed?
So ostensibly you would see a deviation from the average behavior of the size of your beams if they were not being focused as much, and you would see a larger area.
So this observer is in a smaller void.
It's a small
void. The void seems to end here around Z of 0.5 or so or 0.05 or so. This observer is not sitting in a large void or anything.
It doesn't pick up the large voids.
There are no large voids in this model, so no.
So this is just about a little more than a factor 2 change in scale factor?
E to the 1.5 It's 1.5 E foldings, I guess. So yeah, scale factor. Well, yeah, so about a factor of two change in scale factor. Yeah.
And was there a reason you didn't track it longer? Is it just too expensive, or the plastics?
So this does go out a little farther. The numerical errors started getting kind of large. So the optical integrator we have is only a second order integrator, and so it's converging a little slowly. So part of it was getting a little expensive. But also before we really want to ask questions like that, we want to have a more realistic cosmology. So include more smaller scales before really trying to probe up to really high redshifts. So these are large, not gigaparsec scale fluctuations, but still pretty large fluctuations. We want to resolve more scales before we try and make statements about actual cosmology.
So did you compare this with what you expect from linear perturbation theory?
So we were contacted by a postdoc down in Cape Town who I think wanted to do that, and that's not something we've done yet, but I think that's a goal, yeah.
But this has been, I guess, done 10, 15 years ago. Because I mean, so there are two effects that we could have lost it and then saying that we plan to get that. We just do it on linear perturbation.
Right.
And that gives you the variance. Right? That's right. Linear perturbation theory doesn't give you any mean deviation. That gives you the variance. So, that is the question: is that variance consistent?
There have been more recent papers on that as well. So they were curious, how does this line right here diverge from the average at all? Is it pulled up or down? Mm-hmm. And there are some predictions that it should be, but we don't want to make strong statements about that yet. And part of it's also that we didn't trace too many beams yet, or too many. We didn't integrate along too many geodesics. So the thickness. Did I put that on here? No, I didn't. Okay. So the plots in the actual paper, which I don't have here, but the plots in the actual paper do have actual error bars on these lines, and the thickness, just due to having a finite number of rays, kind of overlapped with that. But in principle, we could integrate more rays and try and resolve any deviation from this line, or from the FRW model. Okay. Right. So again, we have observers in over and under densities. Okay. What else can we look at? Okay, so this right here is more or less a test of the small beam approximation, kind of putting an upper limit on how would the finite beam approximation that's commonly used, how would that break down? So what we can do is integrate along two lines of sight that are separated by some small angle, and the limit that the beam area is infinitesimal, we would expect that the area of the beam enclosed by two light rays separated by a small angle is infinitesimal. We expect the Sachs optical equations to agree along those two directions. And so this is a plot of the difference that we see by integrating along two lines of sight as a function of beam separation for two beams. And so So we do see, indeed, for beams with negligible separation, we see agreement with the Sachs optical equations are the metric that both beams are probing is the same. And as you go to larger and larger angular separation, especially as you go to higher and higher redshift, those two beams are going to be probing different spacetimes. They're going to feel different metrics, and so you see a deviation there. And this kind of, at some point, saturates and doesn't grow more because there's kind of phenomenon. The amplitude of fluctuations in the spacetime they only get so large. So, okay. All right. So, kind of in conclusion, what I've shown you are basically the tools we've been working on. This so far has been proof of principle type work. But what we're really interested in doing is, probing smaller and smaller scales, probing more realistic cosmologies, doing these n-body simulations, in order to model as realistic cosmology as we can. So, okay. Thank you. go ahead.
You call it, new local measurements public constant by Adam Reese, different by 3.5% from
yep.
the measurement of the CFP.
Mm-hmm.
So you do seem to have possible variations in H.
Mm-hmm.
It's set equal to zero.
I would venture to say that it's possible there is local structure affecting local measurements of HNOT compared to out to the CMB. But again, I don't want to claim we've done something that resolves an effect like that for certain, because as I said before, we need to resolve smaller scales and model a more realistic cosmology before making definitive statements about something like that.
Another comment is, it would be interesting if you could redo it with the metropolitan body background.
Mm-hmm.
So it could put quite different results.
Because
it has an energy built in initially.
Yeah.
Which you don't have that.
It has a large radial inhomogeneity built in.
The perpendicular parallel are different.
Mm-hmm.
If I tell you there is only one age, so that this could produce significant different results.
Okay. Yeah, it'd be interesting to look at.
Any other questions? It's a bit, it's the first speaker again.